I get a lot of emails and messages from listeners, people who connected with something that we talked about on the show, people wanting to share their experiences with mental health in general, some folks just wanting to say hi or say keep up the good work, and it's great. I'm always delighted, always honored, even if these messages are really common. You know what's less common? Getting an email from a listener who is also one of the stars of Baywatch. Yet here we are. It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. Alexandra Paul wrote in to talk about her struggles with anorexia and bulimia as a child and then into her modeling career and into her acting career. She says she has abstained from binging and purging for the last 30 years, but it still, to this day, requires vigilance. Said she'd be happy to come on the show to talk about eating disorders if I wanted. And I'm like, yeah, of course. Alexandra played Stephanie Holden on Baywatch, hardworking lifeguard, loyal friend.
I'm Stephanie Holden. I'm subbing for Jill while she's on vacation.
I'm Miss Buchanan. Welcome to Baywatch.
Thank you.
She was in Christine, the Stephen King killer car movie.
You know, I thought girls were supposed to be jealous of other girls, not cars.
This car's a girl.
Oh, please.
Really?
Cut it out. Don't.
What? Don't like me slapping your girl?
And she was in a movie I loved, Dragnet, 1987, Tom Hanks and Dan Aykroyd. Alexandra played a character always referred to as the Virgin Connie Swale.
Help! Help!
Hang in there, miss. I'm coming.
Thank God. She needed a virgin.
You're still a virgin? My hat's off to you, ma'am. Hope you stay that way.
But before all that, when she was growing up, Alexandra remembers some warning signs.
Around maybe when I was 12, I started getting up in the middle of the night every so often and sneaking downstairs and having some grape nuts with lots of sugar on it. My mom restricted sugar in the house. Oh. And then I would sort of sneak upstairs again. But that I didn't really put two and two together. My parents
this sounds
were going,
like a kid wanting to have some sugar to me. I mean,
yeah, but later I realized with someone with an eating thing that I was using food to soothe, and using food I couldn't go back to sleep. So using food instead of taking care of myself and getting back to sleep. So, but my eating really came up when I was in 10th grade, and first when I was in 9th grade and being at boarding school, I would see the older girls weighing themselves, and I never thought about anything about how you looked or how much you weighed. But these were girls who were so pretty and popular, and they looked always unhappy when they got off the scale. And that made me start thinking about my own, am I acceptable if they're not? And that was the first sort of recognition that I might not be acceptable how I am.
So how did it transform from this initial inkling of like, oh, you know, these girls who are older and seemingly doing really well are concerned about this. Maybe I should think about this. All these sort of signs that's telling you, that your body is telling you. How did that blossom into what we would think of as a true disorder?
Well, I think the catalyst was for me, and everybody is different, was that when I was 16, I got very sick. I had a blockage in my bile duct, and they didn't know for a long time what it was. And I had to be isolated from other kids because they thought I had hepatitis. And then I had to have surgery where they literally opened me up from my sternum down to my belly button, because it was the 70s. There's no such thing as laparoscopic surgery.
Yeah, they go in there.
And the doctor actually, interestingly, said that the reason they thought that this came up at that time, because I was born with this blockage, was that my parents were getting divorced, and it was a way for me to psychologically try and bring them back together. Now, I just poo-pooed that when I first heard it. But I do think that there was my body was reacting to my parents' divorce. And so after when I got out of that surgery, I had lost 10 pounds and I never wanted to go back to the person that I was because I had gone through so much. And so that loss of 10 pounds was a tangible proof that I had changed. And I didn't, because I didn't want to go back to the person I was before, that also meant the physical person, which meant that I wanted to keep that weight off. And then I also never wanted to get sick again. And so I started to get very focused on food. So the psychological mixed with the physical, and I became anorexic at first.
So it turned from there into anorexia. And what was that? How did that present? What was that all about?
The anorexia started off, as I said, with me trying to be super healthy. And so I started to slowly take food out that I didn't think was healthy. And then it became this where I could hardly eat anything. And it became a goal not to eat, because that also showed my strength to be able to abstain. Interestingly, though, when you're anorexic, you also dream about food. I stole food from the girl next door in my dorm room because I knew her mother had sent cookies. And you become sort of, and morally, that is something, I have very high moral standards, but I noticed that I lied and in that instance, stole food. It makes you... like a drug addict, except for it's the opposite. You become so I'm denying myself. And then, so every so often I would have to go and, like, for example, take a couple of Maria's cookies.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to ask about that. So you were eliminating things from the list of what you would eat, but then you would be transgressive and steal food and eat it.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense, really. Humans are really complicated because I think I tried to abstain, but it's a very primal urge to eat. And then when you do deprive yourself, you want something like sugar, which fuels your brain and is probably, humans run mostly on carbohydrates. Probably why I went for sugar. And I also, to this day, have an addiction to sugar. I definitely struggle still with sugar. So the anorexia lasted about, maybe 6-7 months. And my sister came to visit me at boarding school and saw how thin I was and told my parents. And they immediately yanked me out of school and put me in therapy. So I went to therapy and was basically sort of given permission to eat, which is what I desperately wanted. So I became a binger and a purger for the next 12 years.
Wow. So that's bulimia then. So there was a shift.
Now, I wasn't doing a lot of binging then, but when I was given permission or basically told I had to gain some weight if I wanted to go back to boarding school, and I wanted to. I enjoyed my school. I didn't want to be home with one of my parents in the dead of a New England winter when my family was all broken up. No, I wanted to go back to be with my friends. So I started to eat and I couldn't control it. I went overboard. So I went from one side of the spectrum to another and I couldn't stop binging. I didn't know how to be satiated. And that's because I hadn't dealt with my psychological issues yet.
I'm curious, when you talked about the therapist that you saw giving you permission to eat, I'm interested in that word permission. Like, what was permission before that happened, and why was this person so powerful in changing the course?
Well, I wanted to go back to school. So it was a negotiation, but B, I wanted to eat. I dreamt of eating. I wanted to, but I felt like if I did it myself, I was weak. So if my parents were quote unquote forcing me and the therapist was telling me I had to, then I did start eating. I kicked and screamed, but part of me was so happy to be able to eat again. The problem was I couldn't eat like a normal person. I went to binge to the other end of the spectrum.
And so then you have permission to eat, then you're eating and throwing it up, then that turns into a bulimia situation?
I'm eating until I feel sick. And so I don't remember the first time I threw up, but I do remember that I felt so sick that I threw up. And then I realized, oh, wow, maybe I can literally have my cake and eat it too. It became a way to deal with the fact that I couldn't stop eating. So some people in eating disorders, they're the anorexics. There's the overeaters who just binge. And then there's people like I who had to binge and purge. And I found extreme relief in the purge. It was really all about the purge after a while. But in the beginning, there's no doubt that I started throwing up because I couldn't control my eating. And in boarding school, it's hard. And that means you have to go into bathrooms that no one is around. I remember throwing up in a plastic bag in with the shower on. And you know, it's full of lying and secrecy.
And so but it got you back to boarding school though.
It did. It got me back to boarding school. Yeah.
You talk about, how you loved the purge. What felt so good about the purge?
The thing about when you're binging is that you're not thinking, you literally, when I knew I was going to binge, and I'm talking now, I can't remember so much about boarding school. It was a little more controlled, but we did have buffet breakfast and lunch. So, but when I was older, you'd sort of know when you were going to binge. You'd sort of, because you kind of have to block out time for a binge. You need to go get the food for a binge. So it's a ritual, just like drug addicts often have a ritual in terms of when they will inject. And so it takes time. So that process takes you away from what's really going on in your life. It could take an hour or two. And then you throw up because you feel so sick. And there's that exhaustion from throwing up, which is really hard on your body. And a literal purging. You feel cleaner again. Not great. You still have a lot of self-loathing. But for me, the purge part was very important.
When this was happening, and you were back in boarding school and the binging and purging was happening, did you think, I got this locked down, I got this figured out? Or did part of you say, oh, I'm really messed up here. So this isn't going to work long term.
No, I never said it wasn't going to work long term. I definitely was, I thought I was never going to be a normal person again. And I want to tell you now that I haven't binged in over 30 years now. So it's huge, huge. Because for 12 years, I was sure I couldn't understand people who didn't want who could stop eating before they were full to being sick. I thought they were kind of lying to me or that it was a big secret. And just like I have never felt a desire to drink alcohol, alcoholics might look at me and go, oh, I don't, that's amazing. I felt that way about food.
Okay. How did you get into, and then you became a movie star.
Listen to this, John. Before okay. that, I became a model.
Ah.
Like I threw myself into the career that would be most damaging.
Toxic, yeah. Just ahead, woman with eating disorders enters the modeling industry. What could go wrong? You know what I like? I like when things are easy. Man, easy things are just the best. Because obviously, there are plenty of parts of life already that can be very, very difficult. So bring on the easy. My favorite easy things, I have to admit, are when something seems like it would be difficult, but turns out to be easy. Oh, I love that. Case in point, building your own website and web presence with Squarespace. I did this years ago and found it to be delightfully simple. I can build a site, make changes, redesign everything if I want, all very simple. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. You don't need to be a web guru. You become the guru. Start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. You can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. They accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even sell access to your video library by adding a paywall to your content. So why not get started now? Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. squarespace.com/depresh. Back with Alexandra Paul. When we left her, she had developed anorexia, then bulimia, then a brand new modeling career. How did that get started? Were you just spotted on the street, or did you go out for it on purpose, or what?
I went out for it on purpose. I went to Elite myself without telling my parents. It was probably a very strong need for validation. After 2 years, I left modeling. So it was before my senior year, and then the year after I graduated, I had to leave modeling because my bulimia got so bad. And I did tell my agents why I was. Yeah. And they also told, you know, they would tell me sometimes you're too heavy, you know, you need to lose weight, which would.
What does someone with bulimia do in the modeling industry? And in what year was this then?
This was 1981.
81. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So was it even seen as being a disorder? Was it even seen as being a bad thing then? Or is that just something that everybody did?
You know, I didn't talk to a lot of models, but now I see that. I thought they were naturally thin and that I was the only one.
And so you leave modeling, and is that when you get into acting? The second worst profession for somebody with an eating disorder?
Let me tell you something, John, though. When I went to acting, it was like this weight was lifted off because you didn't have to be 35, 25, 35, which was the measurements on people wanted on your card, you know, and you didn't have that one size fits all kind of rule that you had in modeling much more. So it actually felt liberating, even though the first role I did was, yes, I left modeling. I moved to Canada to be with my boyfriend. And then while I was there, just a couple months later, they called me back from the last audition I had done as a model, which usually it was commercials or soaps, but I had gone up for this TV movie about models where they went looking for an unknown girl and they wanted to see me again. So I ended up being cast in that role. It was the lead role of a TV movie called Paper Dolls, which ended up being very successful. It was one of the top five TV movies of 1982. And back then, TV movies were a big deal, the ABC movie of the week.
Sure. And then you were off to the races. You said that you'd been in therapy while you were modeling. Did your therapist ever say, hey, you got something going on here that you should, that we should work on?
Yeah, I don't remember. I'm sure probably, but.
Or were you keeping it a secret from them what you were doing?
No. No, I was in therapy for eating disorders, so yes.
So you knew something was happening.
Yeah, and my parents knew, and my boyfriend knew, but it keeps you from getting close to people because you have to have time and space to be able to binge and throw up. And so it definitely keeps you from people this, like probably every addiction does.
That's interesting. So you don't want people seeing the truth of what you're doing? Like, is it a matter of not having the time to spend with people or not being able to give yourself over emotionally to people when you say not being close?
Well, you don't want to be too close. You don't want people in your space too much, because I wanted to have, I'll speak for myself, I wanted to have time to be able to binge and purge. And if I was living with somebody or had roommates or had went out a lot, going out was scary because that meant that if we went to dinner, there was food. And then I would, it's humiliating. It's not cool. It's not something you do with other people, like drinking or doing drugs. People can do that. You're going to the store and buying just the most, for me, it was the most junk filled, you know, ice cream and cookies and things that, well, things that my mom restricted when we were kids. And then eating them in a way that is not with a fork, you know, not with a napkin, usually right out of the package, and then kneeling in front of a toilet and throwing it all up. So there's nothing graceful about it. And it has given me such humility, because I saw that how I could be like that. And nobody could tell me anything about what they've done that would shock me or disgust me, because I've already been so disgusted with myself that anybody else, I can relate.
So you do the successful television movie, and then, you know, when I got in touch with you, I immediately thought the Virgin Connie Swale from Dragnet, and I know the Stephen King movie Christine was one of your earlier things that you did. Sounds like you got going pretty quick after you started with the acting. You moved up the list, so to speak. And I imagine all these food issues, all these eating issues were right there by your side.
Right there. I was really functioning. I was a very functioning person. And I was full of, you know, one thing about eating and being a binger is about appetite. And I did have a huge appetite for life, for I wanted to save the world. I wanted to have sex. I wanted to speak out. And food was the way that I think I channeled a lot of that energy into food, because it's socially acceptable. Like I said, that was a good girl. But I also was able to have wonderful boyfriends, wonderful relationships, very healthy sex life, very healthy relationships. I was able to really function well. But at the same time, I had this demon, and it kept me from really having, God, I can't explain it. Because I did make, it was a very good time, but I also had these binges, which often were periods where they would be daily, or periods where they would be once a week, but four times in a day. And certainly, yes, on set, you know, having lunch and feel like I had to go out and show people that I was a normal person and that I ate normally meant that I would eat things I didn't want to eat. And then I would throw them up. So, you know, what I learned was that, and this is what I, is that being authentic was what I wasn't being. And that was why I had an eating disorder. I wasn't really speaking up for myself. And now...
Being authentic in what way and to whom?
And, you know, I didn't understand it then, but now, because I'm 57 and I am authentic, I certainly recognize when I'm not being authentic. It was just about saying what I wanted. If I didn't want to be around someone, didn't want to go to lunch with someone, which is everyone in back then was lunching. And if I didn't want to have a certain friend, or I didn't want a boy to be around me, I couldn't really say it. And that was being able to say no. And I so wanted to be liked that I gave up a lot of myself to other people. And when I came home, I treated myself by binging and purging. And yeah.
So again, that's something you could control. That's something that you can elect to do in a world where you didn't feel like you had that in other way, in interpersonal or professional relationships.
Yeah, I felt like I was out of control and doing a lot of things I didn't want to do because I wanted to be nice and good. And so I'd go home and I'd be bad and also treat myself. And there was a feeling of, it's complicated because I just felt like I was doing something for myself and letting out another side of me. Or I had to let out that side of me because I wasn't letting it out in real life. That's for sure. And for years, I had this feeling literally in my chest, behind my sternum. It felt like a slight pain and it would come up and I would feel like I needed to binge to be able to get rid of that pain. And it would get rid of that pain because I would feel so in pain from binging and then so tired from purging. It was a physical feeling, and I don't have that feeling anymore.
So were you doing more and more and more of this? Like, did it follow that addiction cycle where the amount you used to do before wasn't enough? You've got to ramp it up even further?
Yes. And I went on antidepressants to help with that, to help cope with the cycle of binging and purging that I couldn't get out of. And for about 9 months, and I guess I got out of it because I did stop the antidepressants. So I was situationally depressed. And that helped, and therapy helped. Me recognize why, but it didn't give me a how.
Didn't give you a how of to get better?
Yeah, how to stop. I mean, it made me understand myself, how I wasn't being authentic. I started to get, well, you know, and when you ask, did it keep just getting worse and worse and worse? There were times when it was better than others, probably because my situation was better. If I was less stressed, then I wouldn't binge and purge as much. If I was able to do more of if I wasn't being inauthentic, like telling people, sure, yes, I'll do that, or I'll do this, and yes, I'm this. But it was in 1991. And my friend Jocelyn, who also had an eating disorder. I was honest about my eating disorder by then, by the way. And I told people I was bulimic. I just would never tell them right before a binge. I would maybe say, yeah, I threw up last night. But yeah, I'm feeling good today. That was my honesty. But I could never call somebody right before and say, help me get out of this. When my friend Jocelyn asked me, so how are you doing with throwing up? And I said, fine. By then I'd started keeping a calendar of when I was throwing up, and it was 4 times a month, which would average out to once a week, but actually usually it was clustered into 1 week. So I felt like this is as good as it gets. This is it. This is pretty good. So I said, fine. And she said, is fine good enough? And I realized, no. It wasn't. And I was 28 at the time. And she said, do you want to go to an OA meeting? And I said, okay. I had tried OA once when I was 18, but it wasn't the right meeting. It was for...
OA is Overeaters Anonymous?
Yes, Overeaters Anonymous. And there's so many... It should be Disordered Eating Anonymous, because it's not just overeaters, it's undereaters, it's people, anybody with any kind of disorder. And I had gone to a meeting when I was 18, one of them. And it wasn't right for me. The women were all a lot older and they were dealing with being overweight and not, I think it was binging more than binging and purging. And so it was different. I felt like I couldn't relate. And So when I started going to meetings with young women in their 20s and early 30s who were bulimics, within a month, I stopped throwing up. 1 month, I stopped throwing up. And I started doing the 12 steps. Got myself a sponsor and started doing the 12 steps.
Was there a moment at that meeting where you said, okay, this is where it stops?
I remember the last time I threw up, which was that I was coming back from a protest, and I was going to have lunch with someone I didn't want to have lunch with. So I had lunch with him and then came home and threw up, probably binged on the way home, you know, bought more food and then threw up. And I don't think I said, this is the end. No, I didn't say I'm never throwing up again. No, because I didn't believe that I could yet. But the next day, I guess I didn't. And then the next day I didn't. And I went to meetings where I heard women who didn't and who stopped. And it was so amazing to me. And I think when you hear about people who are successes, which is something you don't hear about in therapy because you're only talking about yourself. When you see other people who are successful, that is one of the one of the gifts of being in rooms with other people with your addiction.
So then what happened with your body when you stopped doing that?
Guess what? I lost weight. It was amazing.
How about your health? Did you feel better? I would imagine you felt better.
I felt like my, well, and it, I didn't, right away I didn't, because I didn't believe it. I was terrified that I would end up misstepping, going back to my old ways. But but when I was a year or 2 years out, if you asked me about it, I would start to...
Take your time.
I would start to weep because I couldn't believe that I was no longer bulimic. And it was such a weight off your shoulders. You know, you become an addict on something because you think it's going to solve something, and then it just gives you so many bigger problems. And yes, you don't have to deal with what you originally became an addict over subconsciously, but you do make your life so much worse. It is really, running away from pain just gives you more pain. And it's not until took me 12 years to realize more to realize that.
So you stop binging and purging, and you know, I imagine you go back to work. You're making movies, you're making TV shows. You know, you're back into the stress and the grind of having a job and making a living and, you know, pursuing your livelihood. Did that make it harder? Did that make it easier? Like, how did your quest for a healthier life mesh with the job in the industry you were in?
Just for beautifully. I mean, I like I said, that, you know, the industry never told me to lose weight because I was always within an acceptable, I mean, I'm tall, I'm 5'10", and I'm built not curvaceous. So, you know, it was just me who hated my body. And the industry didn't tell me to lose weight. I was offered the role on Baywatch, which is a television show that you have to be in a bathing suit every day. And I was offered that role a year after I became abstinent from throwing up. And I never would have taken that role if I was bulimic. Never. Because it would have, well, maybe I learned my lesson about after being a model. I wasn't going to put myself into the fire again, where it would make me so body conscious. But I felt so free from that, from being over this obsession with, what am I going to eat and can I control myself and everything, that I probably had a much healthier attitude than a lot of the women about my body because I was just so grateful I could be there.
Yeah. I mean, I know plenty of people in recovery. I know plenty of people who've dealt with addiction, and it's not a it's not always a smooth road. It's often a bumpy road. And there's, if there isn't relapse, there's at least temptation. There are sponsors to help, help keep you on track. People you could call in a pinch. Was this kind of addiction recovery process the same? Did you have a sponsor? Did you get those temptations?
I did the 12 steps with a 12 step sponsor. And I had a sponsor whom I called every day for 10 years. Mm. And even back then, you know, I was on location. I remember once in Yugoslavia. And, you know, back then in 92, you making a transatlantic call was very expensive. So after shooting, I would, and it was the winter, I would walk over to the post office from my hotel to the post office where there was 24-hour phones and call him and just talk for a few minutes and just sit, you know, and that, and then go back. And I even went, I remember to a meeting in Yugoslavia. I wasn't sure if it was it definitely wasn't an OA meeting. I think it was an AA meeting. I didn't understand a word. Uh-huh. And I didn't even, all I did was cry in the back. Just cry in the back of the room.
Sometimes the quest for health takes you to a Yugoslavian post office and sometimes to a AA meeting in a language you do not understand.
I think it was that discipline. I didn't have, after that first month, I did not throw up again. And I believe that in the last 30 years, I've only binged or sort of, yeah, gotten to bingey mode maybe 5 times. I just feel like because I started, you know, those boundaries I set around people now and so that I could throw up, now my boundaries are more clear about what does Alexandra want and need. And I'm not so focused on people thinking I'm nice. I want them to respect me, but I don't need them to think I'm nice. That was really, I value kindness, but I think that's different than being nice.
That's Alexandra Paul. She still acts in a lot of movies and TV. She's also an activist and a health coach. Like she said, Alexandra's eating disorders happened quite a while ago. It's been 30 years since her last binging and purging. Listening to her story, it struck me how alone she was during these struggles, how little was known about eating disorders at the time. Turns out, a lot more is known now, and it's kind of mind-blowing. The leap in knowledge on this topic is like going from the Wright brothers to the space program. We'll hear about that in just a moment.
Hi, my name is Graham Clark, and I'm one half of the podcast Stop Podcasting Yourself, a show that we've recorded for many, many years. And at the moment, instead of being in person, we're recording remotely, and you wouldn't even notice. You don't even notice the lag.
That's right, Graham. And the great thing about this... Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Okay, and...
Okay, go ahead.
And you can listen to us every week on MaximumFun.org.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
Your podcasts.
Schmanners. Noun. Definition. Rules of etiquette designed not to judge others, but rather to guide ourselves through everyday social situations.
Hello, Internet. I'm your husband, host Travis McElroy.
And I'm your wife, host Teresa McElroy.
Every week on Schmanners, we take a look at a topic that has to do with society or manners. We talk about the history of it. We take a look at how it applies to everyday life. And we take some of your questions. And sometimes we do a biography about a really cool person that had an impact on how we view etiquette. So join us every Friday and listen to Schmanners on MaximumFun.org or wherever podcasts are found.
Manners, schmanners. Get it?
Dr. Jillian Lampert is an expert on eating disorders. She's the chief strategy officer for the EMILY program, a treatment organization specializing in eating disorders. We had some audio difficulties with our conversation, but you'll understand her. I told Dr. Lampert about how Alexandra Paul described a surgery and her parents' divorce as marking the onset of her problems.
If you would have asked me 15 years ago, I would have said, oh yeah, it probably was the traumatic event and the disruption in her family relationship and maybe societal pressures. That's what we would have said about 15 years ago. What I would say today is one of the most interesting pieces of that story is the weight loss that she had, because now we know a lot more about the neurobiology of eating disorders, and we know a lot more about genetic predispositions. And we know that some people are at much higher risk for an eating disorder when they change the way they eat or when their weight declines, as in that story. And so we think there's it's almost a biological trigger that happens in the brains of people that are genetically susceptible to eating disorders, that the brain says, oh my gosh, weight loss, let's get obsessed about food, in a way that's not quite the same as we've had a famine and we want to search for food and we really want to make sure we get enough, which happens for most people when they don't have enough food. For some people, we think it's that their brain wiring is just a little different, and it's not good or bad, it's just a little different, that puts them at risk for when that happens, their brain takes a whole different path that says, I'll get obsessed about food, but in a way that's really hard to shake and a way that will make your life miserable.
What is it about that initial weight loss, that initial event, that kind of lets the genie out of the bottle? Like, is there some sort of chemical response when that happens that just lights the fuse?
Yep, absolutely. So we think it's, you know, and there's a lot more research to be done here, but the early findings show that there's a connection with anxiety. We know that anxiety often happens with eating disorders. That's similar brain circuitry. And you can think of that in a way of really high noticing, that just every stimuli is really noticeable. And so that brain circuitry is just sort of a normal part of many people's lived experience who end up being susceptible for eating disorders. And then they have this weight loss, their diet changes and their food intake changes. And their brain says, oh, you know what? I feel less anxious when we don't eat as much. That's fantastic. Let's not do that. Because of the change in dopamine, the way that, and serotonin we think as well plays a part, that the brain actually feels less anxious when eating decreases. And so people feel less anxious. And they also sometimes feel like what can feel like a bunch of events swirling around them in their life feel a little bit more manageable, or they feel a little bit more in control of something in the midst of sort of swirling things. And so it feels soothing. For most people, being hungry and losing weight and not having enough food feels miserable. But for people who are susceptible genetically, it doesn't actually feel that miserable in the beginning. It gets to feel pretty miserable, but in the beginning, it doesn't feel as miserable.
It makes me think of people with addictions, you know, people who deal with alcoholism, where that drink or those three or four drinks are what kind of set them at ease and make them feel, okay, now I can handle things. What are the overlaps between something like bulimia and addiction? Is it considered an addiction?
It's not considered an addiction. It's in a different part of the DSM. You know, the DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that classifies mental health diagnoses. So it's in a different section in the eating and feeding disorder section. The similarities are in some of those neural pathways, right? The dopamine circuitry. Dopamine gets a response related to, you know, petting my dog, which makes me feel happy. Shopping makes me feel happy. Eating makes me feel happy. Drugs might make me feel happy. Gambling, whatever it is that gives us dopamine hits. So it's that's a really well-traveled pathway. It doesn't necessarily mean that everything on that pathway that triggers us to feel happy is addictive. The interesting differential, you know, that seems sort of obvious when you think about it, is that people have to eat to survive, and people don't need alcohol to survive. And that's where we have to manage an experience with food and an experience with eating and experience with self in a way that requires some differences in treatment. So there's some similarities, and certainly we see a high co-occurrence among people with substance use disorder and an eating disorder, particularly bulimia. which we think actually has to do with some other traits, you can say neurobiologically mediated traits, that make some of us a little more impulsive, a little more chaotic, and some of us a little more rigid, a little more ordered, a little bit more controlled, a little bit more risk averse. And those traits also seem to play out in people who end up with eating disorders. There's sort of a subset of people who are a little more controlled and a little bit more harm avoidant, and people who are a little more impulsive and a little more chaotic. And the folks who are a little more impulsive and chaotic tend to end up, if they end up with an eating disorder, it's more around the bulimia part of the spectrum. So we know that there's this sort of shared pathway with some differences.
It seems like there's a lot more positive messaging out there, a lot more healthy information. And, you know, there's groups like the Emily Program, which is wonderful. But then there's also social media, and there's Instagram, where people put up modeling shots of themselves, basically. It's a whole thing. Is it getting harder or easier to fight these kinds of things and to educate people about the reality of it?
I think it's getting easier. I think there's a wider array of messaging out there, right? For every picture you can see on Instagram of somebody that has the perfectly curated life and body and food, you can also see some really great body neutrality or body acceptance or body positivity posts. So there's a lot wider array of information than there's ever been. So I think that helps. And there's also a lot quicker avenue to getting people information than there's ever been. So while that's sort of a double-edged sword, there's a lot of access to inaccurate information. There is a lot more access to accurate information. And I think there's also some decreasing stigma that eating disorders are something that we just didn't talk about. You know, they have so much stigma. I had an eating disorder when I was in high school and college for 7 years, and it was the thing that nobody talked about. Nobody knew how to talk about. It was a secret. It was very shameful. It was terrifying. And that experience is changing for the most part, not entirely, but as we've gotten more awareness as a society and more availability of treatment and more availability of information, it's a little bit easier to let people know, here's what it looks like. Here's what you might be struggling with. This thing you're struggling with actually has a name, and there is treatment, there is help, there is support, and you can get better. And that's one of the most beautiful things, that people can recover from eating disorders and go on to have a life free of an eating disorder. And that message is much more broadly sort of accepted and out there in the world versus, you know, 15, 20 years ago when we're like, oh, eating disorders, that's like a lifelong thing. People never get better. That is absolutely untrue. People get better.
Is it putting it entirely behind them, or is it a matter of managing it?
It's a great question. And everybody's experience is different. So I want to acknowledge that people have different experiences. Now, I would say, you know, if insurance coverage works out and people are able to access care and all of those other barriers work out, we can keep people in treatment and connected long enough to get through what they need to get through, to really do the work they came to do, and to get a resolution of the eating disorder. They may still be, and they very likely will be, the same, maybe sort of hyper aware of noises or sounds or wind or feelings or sensations person that they always were, that put them at least in part at risk for an eating disorder. They might have a much keener hyper awareness of their body than other people do. And that shows up like, hey, you know, here's how I feel when I eat this. Here's how I feel when I eat that. That's just a keener awareness for many people that have had an eating disorder or are struggling with them. It's the experience is loud. The experience of living is loud. And that's not necessarily going to change. Like, people who resonate with that are like, yeah, the like sun is really bright and the wind is really noticeable and the lights are bright and the sound is loud and I don't like this feeling or that feeling and I have to touch everything in a store before I buy it. And why do they put those tags in clothes? That's so annoying. Love that they printed the tags on clothing. Just a tactile sensation experience. That's genetic. That's how we're wired. And that sticks around. And so when people can connect to their bodies in a way that say, oh, this is my experience, then the like, what about food and what will it do to me and how will this be experienced and what will people think of me? Those thoughts can quiet down because you're really more connected to what your experience is. And I think that's the sort of rest of the way in treatment we can help people with now.
I think I didn't quite understand that you're talking about people who are very sensitive to sound and wind and to physical sensation are people who are more susceptible to eating disorders?
In a way. So that we think that that neural circuitry that is connected to having traits that are expressed as I like things sort of ordered. I like predictability. I like to know what's going to happen. I'm not particularly risk-taking. Those traits are also connected to, I sort of know how people feel when I'm in a room. I can read the room. I have a sensitivity towards lights and sound and wind and touch. The term that I've coined is like a high def living. And when I've said that in groups of people who work in eating disorders or have had eating disorders, they're like, yeah, it's like HD living. Everything's just a little crisper and clearer and louder and brighter. And that is that's just a genetically mediated neurobiological trait. And that's really common among people who have an eating disorder or had an eating disorder. And we didn't really know that before.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So then is the bulimia or the anorexia an attempt to mitigate that, to kind of mute those sensations? Like, what's the connection between that and the behavior associated with an eating disorder?
Yeah, so it's more of a side effect than an attempt. And I think that's a really common element we hear in people's story. And again, everyone's experience is their own. I think that when we used to think of somebody sort of chooses to do these behaviors to manage their experience, it's really probably more that when they do behaviors that are super common, people go on diets all the time, people eat past the feeling of fullness all the time, people worry about food and their weight all the time, right? That's just a kind of ubiquitous experience in our world. When people do that, some people that are at risk for an eating disorder, find that behavior soothing to their world experience in some way. And so it's like a side effect of the behavior. We do the behaviors, we go on a diet, we worry about our weight, we try to lose weight, we even try to be healthier and we eat more whatever we think are the foods we should eat more of. And some people get sort of sucked into this black hole of, I have to do it better, I have to do it right, I have to do it this way. And it feels a little soothing. It sort of numbs out the world. It makes the world a little quieter. When you're worried about how many calories you're putting in your body, and that's really intensively important to you, you don't have a lot of time or bandwidth to notice all the other stuff in life. And so that's, we think it's really an experience people have, more so than an experience people seek or behaviors they seek to do to get that experience. They get in that dark hole and they're like, oh, yeah, it's dark down here, but it also feels a little soothing.
So, okay, so we have the information about the genetic predisposition, and then we have this information about the sensitivity, the light and sound and wind sensitivity, which is just going to blow my mind the rest of the day. I've just resigned myself to that. And it sounds like these are relatively recent developments in terms of the understanding of what we're facing. Are there other like things that have blown your mind when they finally got revealed as like, oh my gosh, this is part of it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this stuff is so cool. And it is. It's only the last 10 years or so that we've known any of this about the brain circuitry. One of the other things that I think is amazing is that people who struggle with overeating in particular, where they just feel out of control around food, maybe it's just some foods, but they just feel like those foods are not their friends. They come home from a busy day and the pan of brownies is on the counter, and before they know it, they've eaten the whole thing and they don't even quite know how they got there. And then they feel horrified that they've done this. But there's something so alluring about those brownies that now we know that some people's brains are really interested in the experience of eating. Their brains are like, we love to eat. This is great. Let's do it. It feels it's our dopamine is so excited about anticipating it. And so we see in the cool neurobiology, functional MRI imaging studies that the researchers have done, we see that some people's brains are really much more interested in food. And those people may be at much higher risk of an eating disorder that has overeating as an experience, because along with that, they also seem to have a harder time hearing the signal to stop, right? They get this really amped up, like, I want to eat, I want to do this, I want to engage in this, but the signal to stop is a little quieter, and so, or at least a little disproportionate, and so it kind of goes unnoticed, and then they just end up going through that signal, and before they know it, they're totally stuffed. And so when people used to feel like, two things. One, oh, you have so much willpower that you're not eating that you don't eat the brownies like I do. I must just not be trying hard enough, or my willpower is just, there's something wrong with my, the way I'm thinking about it, or I'm just weak or have some sort of moral failing that I can't do that. It turns out it's just your genetics, how your brain's wired, that your brain doesn't really want to stop doing those things quite as much as you might want them to. So that we know is really not a person's, you know, moral failing or character flaw. It's just that they're wired a little differently. And some people are just really interested in food, right? Like if you look at somebody's vacation photos, some of us take pictures of places we went, some of us take pictures of people we saw, and some of us take pictures of the food we ate. But most people don't. Only some people take pictures of the food they ate. And only some people take pictures of just the people they saw. Those are just different neural pathways that we all, they're all normal. They're all distributed across the population. They get hijacked in ways that lead people to get stuck in the illnesses and then feel like they've failed somehow. It's not that they failed. It's that they have an illness. Just like, you know, they broke their leg. People don't think they failed because their leg broke. They have an illness.
Yeah. Why did you choose to break your leg? Well, I had a vote. No, but it's like any other mental disorder. And we talk about all sorts of disorders on this show, as nobody would opt for obsessive compulsive disorder. Nobody would choose to have generalized anxiety disorder. Those weren't elective propositions. They were disorders that developed.
Right. Exactly.
It sounds like so much new information is coming along all the time. It's really exciting, actually. What are some myths that are still out there that just stick in your teeth, that just bug you, that people are still hung up on this obviously untrue thing?
Yeah, I think the, that only women get eating disorders is one of those myths, that people of all genders can get eating disorders. It's, you know, I think we have this bizarre concept that it just happens to women because it happens more frequently to women. There's a lot of data behind, like, why might that be? We believe that estrogen has something to do with the risk at puberty, when most people can trace the beginning of the eating disorder back to. So women are at higher risk, but all people of all genders could get an eating disorder too. And our like belief that it's just about women make all everybody else say like, oh, then maybe I don't have this thing. And it's kept men suffering in silence for decades. It's kept all kinds of people saying like, this must not be an eating disorder. So it's not just about women. And you cannot tell by looking at somebody anything about whether or not they have an eating disorder, that people don't have to be underweight. The majority of people with an eating disorder are not visibly underweight. So this stereotype we have of a really emaciated young female, you know, adolescent who's probably Caucasian is not the majority of people that have eating disorders. It's just the majority of the pictures we see and the images we see about who gets eating disorders. But eating disorders impact people of all ages, all races, all everything. They don't discriminate at all.
Dr. Jillian Lampert from the EMILY program, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's great to talk to you.
Dr. Jillian Lampert from the EMILY program. They're at emilyprogram.com. Lots of good information there. And Dr. Lampert sent us some links to the studies that she mentioned, these kind of amazing discoveries that they've been making. Are you a person who geeks out on studies? I kind of am. I like studies. Those links are in the show notes for this episode. Go to MaximumFun.org/depressionmode. You'll find them. Alexander Paul is at alexanderpaul.com. Next time on Depression Mode, an interview with an incredibly funny comedian, actor, and writer. This guy is so hilarious. But he wasn't hilarious during this interview. Like, at all.
I can recognize things on paper as being exciting. I understand that that is the human emotion that coincides with this event, X event. Mm-hmm. But in terms of really feeling it, I feel nothing.
a talk with Joel Kim Booster when he is not doing well. It's going to be a pretty amazing episode. We love it when you recommend Depression Mode to friends. It might help them. Also, something that helps us a lot, hit subscribe, give us 5 stars, write reviews. That helps more people find out about the show, which helps our mission of getting those conversations happening. I want you to know that the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. The Crisis Text Line, also free, always available. Text the word HOME to 741-741. Depression Mode is your show, too. Let us know who you want me to interview, what issues you want to hear more about. We take requests. You can email us at our electric mail address, depressionmode@maximumfun.org. Along the same lines, Depression Mode can only help people, can only entertain, can only exist with the support of listeners. Thank you to those who have joined. If you haven't, it's easy to throw in a few bucks to keep it going. MaximumFun.org/join. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies, Preshies. There's great conversation going on there, great camaraderie and community. I stop by there sometimes. I join in the chats. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DepreshPod. Our Depression Mode newsletter is available on Substack. I'm on Twitter at John Moe, all one word. Hello, credits listeners. There are more trees on Earth than there are stars in the Milky Way. Up to 400 billion stars, but we got 3 trillion trees. We could mail a tree to each star and still have plenty of trees. So let's get going on that project. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out. Building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hi, I'm Daryl from Scotland, and you are not alone in this.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.